You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, the rise of IS continues as Amnesty International accuses the group of ethnic cleansing.
There's an allegation that between 800 and 1700 people were murdered by ISIS and placed in shallow mass graves.
Shashank Yoshi and James Boyes will tell us what, if anything, can be done. Plus, London Mayor Boris Johnson's dream of a hub airport in the Thames estuary is all but dead. Our two experts will give their views. Then we'll check in with our man in Melbourne and we'll speak to the author of a new book who tells us how to spin friends and manipulate people. All that, plus we'll review the week in music. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before any of that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. The United Nations says more than a million people have been displaced by the conflict in eastern Ukraine. It says the number of those forced to leave their homes and businesses has doubled in the past 3 weeks. Meanwhile, Russia says it's altering its military strategy amid continuing fighting in Ukraine and because NATO is to deploy more troops in the region. NATO plans to deploy a force in eastern Europe following Moscow's alleged involvement in the fighting in eastern Ukraine. The Secretary-General of the Council of Europe, Torbjørn Jagland, who's been meeting Ukraine's President, Petro Poroshenko, has called the crisis a failure for the European institutions.
You have been brought into an incredible situation with an open military conflict on your territory. It was imposed on you, and I would like to say that what is going on now in eastern Ukraine should not belong to the 21st century of Europe. It should belong to the past.
Amnesty International claims it has evidence of ethnic cleansing by Islamic State militants in northern Iraq. In a report published today, the group has interviews with survivors of the alleged massacres, which it says took place last month. The UN Human Rights Council has agreed to send investigators to Iraq to examine crimes being committed by Islamic State. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization is warning the Ebola outbreak is putting food harvests in West Africa at serious risk. It's raised a special alert for Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea, the three countries worst affected. The UNFAO says rice and maize production will be particularly badly affected during the coming harvest season. US oilfield services firm Halliburton says it's reached a $1.1 billion settlement to meet most of the claims against it for its role in the Gulf of Mexico oil spill in 2010. Officials say the money is to be paid into a trust until the deal is finalized. Halliburton was a contractor for BP, operators of the Deepwater Horizon rig, which exploded, killing 11 people and causing the worst offshore oil spill in US history. On the eve of talks with European and IMF inspectors in Paris, Greek finance officials say reforms are on target. The so-called Troika of European Union and International Monetary Fund representatives begins its latest review of the country's progress on its obligations this month. Greece has staged a sharp financial turnaround since nearly going bankrupt 2 years ago at the peak of its debt crisis. However, it's still expected to need further concessions from lenders before its debt mountain is considered to be manageable. Greek Finance Minister Gikas Ardouvelis says they're bringing a positive message.
We want to show that we are on target, both on the fiscal side and on structural reforms. August was a month like it is for Americans, for Greeks. The Greek state didn't take vacation and we're ahead of schedule.
French actress Julie Gayet has won a privacy case over a photo published by Closer magazine during its coverage of her alleged affair with President François Hollande. The alleged affair made international headlines after it was revealed in the magazine report in January this year. Closer has already paid damages to the actress for publishing the report. A court in the western Paris suburb of Nanterre has handed photographer Laurent Vieux a suspended fine of €1,000 for taking the photo of the actress sitting at the wheel of her car, considered to be a private space. A plan to build a major new airport to the east of London has been rejected. A government-appointed commission says proposals for an airport in the Thames estuary hasn't made the shortlist of options. Plans to expand Heathrow or Gatwick are now the only options to increase Britain's runway capacity. Monocle is linking up with Japanese media corporation Nikkei. The agreement was signed on Monday and sees Nikkei, one of Asia's largest media companies, take a stake in Monocle. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill. You're listening to Monocle 24 and Midori House, and we're right back after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ut London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Or London.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18.06, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Shashank Yoshi from the Royal United Services Institute and James Boyes, author of Clinton's Grand Strategy, US Foreign Policy in a Post-Cold War World. Welcome both to the programme. We begin the show by discussing the rise of the Islamic State. Earlier today, fighters from the Afghan militant group Hezb-e-Islami announced that they would be willing to join IS militants if they were able to create a true caliphate. News of a possible alliance came as Amnesty International said that there is evidence of ethnic cleansing in Iraq.
I think one of the most well-documented cases at the moment is at Camp Spiker, where there's an allegation that between 800 and 1,700 people were murdered by ISIS and placed in shallow mass graves. And this is a case that very much has captured the attention of the political elite in Baghdad, and they very specifically asked if we would support them in this issue. There have been a number of other smaller incidents around the area that they've also asked for our support.
Well, that was Duncan Spinner, who's head of Iraq for the International Commission for Missing Persons. So as more evidence emerges of a more powerful IS, what is the West supposed to do? James, what is the West supposed to do?
I think slightly above my pay scale. Well, let's be honest, if they're ever going to have an answer to that, the world leaders are meeting in NATO in Cardiff this next 24, 48 hours, so maybe they can come up with some ideas. I'm not optimistic. As an academic, one is always looking to discern between states and non-state actors. And now all of a sudden we have a non-state actor who appears to want to be a state. It's quite remarkable in terms of how this organisation has come together. We can look at some of the membership of it, for example, if we're going to try and find out where it stems from. And a lot of these people are people who were effectively expelled from the Iraqi army when the George W. Bush administration came in and said, we don't need you anymore, you can go home. Oh, and by the way, take all your weapons, etc., etc., along with you. So to the degree that this has been a self-created problem, I think we need to look back at and try and find the roots of that. How we find a way moving forward with this is very difficult because, of course, the West has been told over and over again, the population at least, that this is a powerful terrorist organization who might well be having aspirations of sort of international leadership, effectively. We heard it all before about Al-Qaeda. And I think the population is almost tired of this. So it's going to be very difficult, I think, to try and generate the sort of public support that's necessary to lead what would be any sort of a military campaign which would be effective against this organization.
Shashank, how important is this potential tie-up with other militant groups, for example, with the Afghans?
Well, I wouldn't get hung up on the Afghans per se, but the tie-ups with other militant groups broadly is very significant. Don't forget that Al-Qaeda in Arabic means base, right? And they were trying to be an umbrella group in the 1990s for jihadist movements across the world. They created affiliates, and over the years, those affiliates, like that in Yemen or Mali, became far more powerful than the core Al-Qaeda group itself. Now, if the Islamic State is able to persuade others, it is a worthy successor to Osama bin Laden's organization, and particularly if it can persuade those very sophisticated and well-experienced Al-Qaeda affiliates to defect, join the Islamic State. I'm thinking here of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the Yemeni branch with supreme bomb-making skills. That would be incredibly important for its ability to carve out a caliphate, not just in the Middle East, but also show its strength across the world.
And what do you make of these reports, Shashank, from Amnesty International? Is it kind of any... We've seen the TV pictures. We know what's been unfolding over the past few weeks. Is it really any surprise that they are involved in ethnic cleansing?
Not in the slightest. This group, of course, was founded in the idea that sectarian warfare would serve its aims. If they massacred Iraqi Shias, what that would do is force Iraqi Shias to hit back against Sunnis, and Sunnis would therefore feel, I think as James alluded to, that their only protectors were the Islamic State. In other words, sectarian warfare was an instrument of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, an organization that later became the Islamic State. So far from being an isolated incident, this has been something they've been doing for years and years and years.
James, when you look at you talk here about a non-state actor, and it's amazing that that you're talking about actually here were kind of regular troops probably who've now been pulled in by this organisation. What is the appeal, do you think, of IS?
I think that, there's a lot of speculation about this. Certainly some of the things that I've been reading suggest that effectively, they are, and I hate to use the expression, the biggest, baddest group on the block, effectively. And there's a lot of people who are drawn to them because if you were going to go and fight jihad, effectively, you want to be fighting for, the team who look like they're going to be, around the longest and have greatest chance of success, effectively. You don't want to go overseas and risk alienation at home and potential death, etc., for a bunch of losers, effectively. There has to be assumption here that this is the team who have got their act together. They are clearly putting the fear of God, no pun intended, into the West. So if you are going to go, and if you are motivated to go overseas and do this, they seem to be the natural draw, effectively.
Shashank. Can I endorse all of that and add one more thing, which is, don't forget, this is a region, a part of the world, where there is no meaningful concept of citizenship. If you are a young Sunni, you have no entity that wants you as a member. The contract in the Gulf for the Saudis, for the Emiratis, for the Kuwaitis, the Qataris, will give you wealth, will give you jobs, but we're not going to give you citizenship. There's no participation in a joint enterprise. There's no sense of being part of something bigger than yourself. That is what the Islamic State offers, and doubly so in Iraq, of course, where Sunnis have a government that they see as being a Shia-dominated, Iran-backed sectarian persecutor. So this is about a bigger purpose that cannot be offered even by established states in the region, which are bankrupt and politically hollow.
When we talk about them, what the West can do is the best we can hope for. Shashank, perhaps you can come back on this. Is the best we can hope for a situation, a kind of a drone situation for Afghanistan, where we're kind of bombing people on the ground. We're not putting troops on, actually on the ground ourselves, but we're kind of bombing from the air, kind of holding them in check, stopping them getting into kind of too much of a regular army. Is that the pattern?
That's not enough. A military solution... It's part of it. I think the US administration has been unpardonably slow in taking on the Islamic State where it can, but where it's been absolutely correct is to say that only ground forces who are exploiting those airstrikes, and those ground forces have to be Kurds, they have to be Iraqi government forces, they have to be Sunni tribes, and in Syria they have to be the Syrian opposition, they have to exploit those airstrikes. But of course, those airstrikes will have to be an indispensable part of an overall solution.
James, it doesn't sound... I understand the argument. It doesn't sound a huge solution, doesn't it? It just sounds like we're unleashing warfare. We back the Kurds. We know that they've been slightly less than useful in some of the battles up until now without heavy backing from the US. Some of these other groups we're talking about, these tribal groups, they're hardly as well organised as IS. It's a perpetual backing up of slightly, to be rude, a bunch of people who are not very good at winning.
Yeah, ultimately, one of the reasons that ISIS have been so successful is because of the utter incompetence in many ways of the Iraqi army. They've had how many billions thrown at them? They've been led effectively by a very incompetent, and as Shashank referred to, this idea that you've got a leadership within Iraq and a Maliki that has caused an awful lot of problems. George W. Bush invested so much time and political capital in trying to sort of support him that really was a complete waste of time. Fundamentally, what you have here is a situation whereby, we are backing the wrong horse all the time. There is nobody to back over there. And fundamentally, there cannot be a military solution to this. Any military airstrikes will have to be part of a wider diplomatic political solution. The problem with that, of course, is that it means sitting down and negotiating with and dealing with your enemies. And one of the problems which I think has emerged in the post 9/11 world is that the Americans, be they Republicans or Democrat, have a fundamental aversion to the idea of sitting down with people who would very much like to kill you, but as we've learned throughout history, you make peace with your enemies, not with your friends.
Shashank, here in the UK, certainly the tabloids have been dominated by some stories, you know, such as, you know, the rock chick who became a jihadi, the rappers become jihadis. And, you know, David Cameron said, you know, we're going to go slap you on the wrist. We're going to take your passports off you. We might not even let you come back. They're hardly going to be quaking, are they?
No, but the problem is we can't turn ourselves into a police state. And even the prospect of removing passports is going to run into legal challenges, absurd as it sounds. Now, we had a system of control orders in place, and Labour are saying, look, you're talking about control orders. You took these apart. Why are you now raising this again? But of course, control orders only covered about 50 people across their lifespan. How many jihadists are we talking about here? Well, at least 500 Britons who've gone to fight with the Islamic State. I think probably double that if you look at some of the figures. And, you know, you simply cannot effectively put under house imprisonment 1,000 people in the UK. So I have considerable sympathy for the government. These measures are imperfect, but we cannot simply imprison or detain or follow around 1,000 people in perpetuity.
Now, James, some of these people, you know, the rapper, the rock chick, you know, we see photo evidence, we see Twitter feeds, yeah, claiming they've done certain things or claiming they are calling for certain things to be done. But the reality is we can't go on the ground and collect any evidence. You know, what Shashank's talking about here is we can't really have a trial of these people even effectively when they come back, can we?
It's very, very difficult. You know, one sympathises with David Cameron. You know, as British Prime Minister, he has to be seen to be doing something. The problem you have fundamentally comes down to, you know, at what point do you apply the law in a basis which is seen to be appropriate in an open society and within an EU confine, which is going to come down like a ton of bricks upon any efforts to try to, you know, implement many of the ideas that Cameron has stood up in Parliament and said, we're going to do this. Well, fine, but you know, your leading piece had a reference to Amnesty International. They're not going to be happy about this. There's going to be an awful lot of civil liberties groups who aren't happy about this. But what are you meant to do? You know, surely there has to be some way in which you can control the movement of your citizens. And if you believe they're going overseas to commit crimes, you have to do something. What that is at this point, I don't think the government has quite managed to figure out.
And the problem, of course, is if someone's going to Bulgaria or Turkey, mm-hmm, how do you know it's not they've got sorry for a holiday?
Absolutely.
Or it's to commit jihad? If you have intercept evidence, fine, it's easy. Sure. They've talked about this, they've planned it. But for the majority of cases, they are more savvy than to do this online, yeah, where the security service can just pick that up and arrest them.
And as you rightly point out, if they go through a third country, which
as they always do,
absolutely.
Yeah, these arguments feed into, you know, debates about migration, debates, mm-hmm, about Europe, debates about how our courts are run. But Shashank, do you think it's unfair that actually quite a lot of British people, especially newspaper commentators, end up in the position thinking actually nice liberals just can't win against these organisations? They are fighting with a hand tied behind their back. You know, either the judges in Europe or someone is going to stop them doing what seems like the natural thing to do, you know, grabbing hold of these people before they travel or doing something.
We just called David Cameron a nice liberal.
You're going to wreck his prospects for the election.
Absolutely.
Well, look, we've been here before. Remember masking Gerry Adams' voice on television. Mm. Remember detention without trial for members of the IRA. This is not the first time we've had this debate. I hope people with experience of that era, and that's not me, by the way, can come and give us some important lessons about how we dealt with it and what we did right and what we did wrong.
Well, Shashank and James, we're going to pause there for 1 second. But when we return, we're going to discuss the Russian President Vladimir Putin's new military doctrine. Stay tuned.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Well, Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is, of course, Shashank Yoshu from the Royal United Services Institute and America Affairs author James Boyes. We're going to continue our programme by looking at the crisis in Ukraine. On Monday, NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen announced the creation of a rapid deployment force to combat a rising threat from Russia. In response to the West, a top Russian official said that Russia would now alter its military strategy. And as a result of the Ukraine crisis as a result of the Ukraine crisis. James, when we look at what's unfolding here, we're rapidly returning to a Cold War politics. You know, people talked about, oh, we're returning to Cold War politics. Well, we're kind of back there now, aren't we? We saw this week, you know, the Russian president say in private comments, but in a meeting with students, that he felt that Kazakhstan was certainly not a country. It was, you know, a nice kind of attempt to prop up a country, but he knew that the people there really kind of wanted to be part of Russia. You're looking at what his game plan seems to be, attacking everyone on all edges now. You know, the Poles are scared, the Baltic nations are scared. Where are we heading?
You can add to that the fact that they've not denied the fact that Putin has also now said that he could take Kiev anytime he wanted in, was it two days?
I think
it was
48
hours.
Two weeks.
Sorry. I give him too much credit. Absolutely. Now, we sit here talking about this, you know, whilst world leaders are flying into Cardiff, of all places, for a NATO summit. You know, what was NATO put together for? NATO was a defence alliance designed to basically stand up to the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet-led nations in the Cold War. Now, a lot of people of the new generation will have forgotten that, because in the 1990s, NATO was used effectively as a social vehicle to extend, you know, democracy and freedom into Central and Eastern Europe when the European Union effectively proved unable to step up to that task initially for a whole variety of reasons. A lot of people at that point said, you push NATO up to the gates of Moscow, at some point Russia's going to push back. Are we seeing that? A distinct possibility. Thank goodness that Ukraine was never included at that point, because if Ukraine had been part of NATO at this point, they'd be flying around saying Article 5, attack on one is an attack on all.
Would that be a bad thing? We're standing back. We're not arming them. We're allowing them to kind of, you know, face up to Russian tanks coming across the border. We're not doing anything.
Well, what the problem is then you suddenly trigger effectively a war with Russia. Now, I don't think anybody listening to this would think that that would be a particularly good idea. Now, I'm not suggesting for a minute that we stand
didn't
by
they,
and
didn't
have
they say that in 1938?
But of course, you have also have to remember, Russia has adopted a very different attitude towards the Baltic states and Poland, members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, than it has to Ukraine. Now, that's partly because Ukraine is so appallingly governed, so badly run. It's had its own internal vulnerabilities. But it also suggests, in line with what you're saying, actually, if Ukraine had been a member of NATO, we would have run risks, but Putin may never have taken as risky a policy.
Does it feel like that on the ground if you're sitting in Vilnius? You know, we have the president saying the country is, you know, Europe is almost effectively at war.
Well, I'll tell you what, at least Vilnius and others have the promise of a 4,000 strong reaction force, the promise of 4 deployed pre-positioned NATO stockpiles, the promise of new NATO intelligence collection on Europe's borders, surveillance flights. They're getting all of this, you know, training missions. Ukraine? It has none of this. I'd rather be in than out.
And who's paying for all this? This is interesting, because one of the great problems with NATO at the moment is people have roundly mocked the United States over the years for spending so much on its defence at about 4.4% of GDP. It contributes about 74% of overall NATO spending. You know, the European countries to whom the United States is almost certainly at some point going to have to come to the rescue cannot muster the idea of spending 2% of GDP. Only the United States and the UK spend over 2% on GDP defending the very country that they're there to defend, effectively.
We're going to move on, but Shashank, just quickly, do you think this is all huff and puff? Because, you know, Vladimir Putin may be kind of, we know what he's doing in Ukraine, but he's not sending that many troops across the border. And actually, when we look at the Russian military, if you speak to defence analysts, they'll say it's actually still a slightly shaky organisation. It certainly doesn't have
That's true, but I think that's look at 21st century tactics in a very 20th century way. It doesn't matter how sophisticated his satellite technology is. What matters is he has made astute, deft, and very effective use of proxies, deniable actors, backed up by a limited amount of Russian force. And what's he done? He seized Crimea, he's seizing a land bridge to Crimea, and he's preventing a rebel collapse in eastern Ukraine. I'd call that pretty effective.
So I do promise we'll move on in 1 second. Just finally, James, sure. you think that there is no point that he will cross in Ukraine that will get a reaction?
No, I didn't say that. I think what's interesting is in Ukraine, people I know who've been over there say there's a very, very different atmosphere in the country, in the east and the region, the west. At this point, you know, who knows which way it's going to go, but perhaps the easiest solution might be an annexation of part of the country for everybody's best interest at this point.
Now, we're going to quickly look at the idea of London having an airport built in the estuary. This is an ambition of Mayor Boris Johnson. And I've quickly got on the line Tristan McAllister, who's our transport editor. Tristan, is the idea, as they say, dead in the water?
I don't know. It's hard to say here, but of course, this has been a ping pong ball for many years in London, as many of you well know. So I think what is clear today is that we do know that there's yet another sort of mark against the Thames estuary in terms of political support. And I think that as we come up to these elections that are ahead of us, could potentially be a just another political issue.
And do you think that London needs to, and just if you tell me a few seconds, do you think that London needs to come up with a plan that it actually does something about quite quickly?
Well, an interesting fact, Andrew, according to Airports Council International Europe, by 2030, capacity will be significantly restricted in Europe, meaning that there will be a lot of unmet demand, and meaning a lot of airplanes that aren't able to land. So if London can't capture some of that like it could, if it were to build new runways or a new airport, it would lose out financially. And I don't think anyone really wants to see that happen.
Thank you, Tristan. That's Tristan, who's in our New York bureau. He's our transport editor. Shashank, did you think that he's, you know, annoyed about this? Boris Johnson has said it set back the debate by half a century. Is he annoyed about the airport, or is he annoyed about what it says about his ability to get things done, and i.e. potentially one day be PM?
Absolutely. I think that Boris has carved out this fantastically maverick, effective, populist niche for himself over the past several years. And, you know, one of the criticisms of London Mayor is that it doesn't involve that many large-scale projects that an executive office would really involve. The airport question was a way of carving out a role for himself in Britain's long-term infrastructure. I think the fact that he's been set back on this will be deeply irritating. Having said that, in the big picture, of course, things are going very well for him with the way it looks like Tories will not win an outright majority. It looks as though David Cameron will be weakened next year. He'll be standing to be an MP. I think this is a small blip in his overall career, but I think it does set back his ambition to portray himself as a serious reformer and politician rather than just a joke politician.
Boris wanted to be seen as the man with the big ideas. And let's face it, we've been faced by an administration that's kind of prevaricated and dodged and set up this commission so that it kind of didn't have to make its mind up during this term. They need to build an airport, a new runway, probably at Heathrow. They need to kind of face up to public qualms. But for Boris, the problem is, you know, he's also facing up to kind of UKIP, and UKIP aren't that keen on building anything else. They're trying to be the public's friend. So is the man with the big idea no longer required, do you think?
It would be nice to think that anybody had a big idea, quite frankly. It's difficult, you know, you desperately want to take someone seriously in politics at the moment, but where do you look for that? I mean, you know, Boris Johnson, not really. Nigel Farage, not really. I think Cameron's trying to do the best he can under difficult circumstances and doesn't seem to be succeeding in any great extent. You know, if you were going to build a new runway, if you were going to build a runway from scratch, you would never put it at Heathrow. The idea of planes coming in over the capital, the extent they do, I don't believe there's any other major airport in the world that is built to the west of a nation's capital. You put them to the east for obvious reasons. Boris's island looks like it's never going to happen now, and I think the powers that be at Heathrow and Gatwick have nicely strangled it in the cradle.
Shashank, we haven't got long left, but, you know, Nigel Farage, Boris Johnson, there's this belief that we're kind of ending up with a bunch of politicians who are kind of the person who used to bore you in the pub. These are the kind of, like, you know, the wild characters, the mavericks. Why have we got tired of serious politicians?
Well, I think it's partly the fact that we've had a coalition government which has appeared to be more fragmentary, more disunited, weaker. It's struggled to pass through certain key pieces of legislation or big projects which have fallen on the sort of horns of these two squabbling parties. And Farage and co. have taken advantage of that. But of course, Farage represents a very particular phenomenon on a very particular issue. I wouldn't necessarily infer from this that there's some bigger tectonic shift underway. And ditto Boris, he represents a splash of colour in an otherwise fairly drab party setup. I'm not sure this necessarily signifies a huge change underneath British politics.
I tell you what I liken it to, which is, if you look at Question Time on the BBC, for example, the person who always gets the easiest, biggest cheer is the celebrity guest. The person who goes on there, the Russell Brands of the world, he'd go on there, mock politicians, come up with some glib ideas, and they can walk away and never have to actually fulfill any of the ideas that they put to the public on that stage. And it undermines politics in the overall sense, and it actually, I think, empowers people like Farage, because they can build upon that. He's never going to hold executive power in this country, but he can bemoan politicians, come up with harebrained ideas, and then put it to the politicians, who then have to explain to the public why it is that in the real world these things are not implementable.
Well, we're going to leave it there, gentlemen. Two gentlemen who certainly would not bore you in a pub. That's what it's going to say on the poster anyway. I would just like to thank hugely to Shashank Joshi and James Boyes. Thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to check in with our man in Melbourne. We're also going to review the week in music. But before we get started, here's Bill Bingham with the world news headlines.
And some news just in. An Islamic State video has appeared, apparently showing the beheading of Stephen Sutloff, a US journalist being held hostage by the militants. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said US officials are checking the reports. Mr. Sutloff disappeared in Syria in 2013. The United Nations says more than a million people have been displaced by the conflict in eastern Ukraine. It says the number of those forced to leave their homes and businesses has doubled in the past 3 weeks. Meanwhile, Russia says it's altering its military strategy amid continuing fighting in Ukraine and because NATO is to deploy extra troops in the region. Amnesty International claims it has evidence of ethnic cleansing by Islamic State militants in northern Iraq. In a report published today, the group has interviews with survivors of the alleged massacres, which it says took place last month. And U.S. oilfield services firm Halliburton says it's reached a $1.1 billion U.S. dollar settlement to meet most of the claims against it for its role in the Gulf of Mexico oil spill in 2010. Officials say the money is to be paid into a trust until the deal is finalised. Halliburton was a contractor for BP, operators of the Deepwater Horizon rig, which exploded, killing 11 people and causing the worst offshore oil spill in US history. Those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Bill. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we're heading down to Australia. And joining us on the line is our Melbourne correspondent, Adrian Craddock. Welcome to the show, Adrian. Let's start with some international news, which was, I think, took some people by surprise. This is the decision of Australia to give arms to the Kurds. What's behind this decision?
Yeah, well, over the last week, Australia has announced that it's been delivering aid to Iraq. And as you say, they've taken it a step further. They've recently announced this week that they will be flying weapons, in particular mortars and rocket-propelled grenades, into northern Iraq. The reason behind it, it's the same as many world leaders, I would suggest, that Abbott has called this, you know, a humanitarian catastrophe. And I think, you know, if you're not cynical about it, he really wants to help the situation and bring an end to it. Although what's interesting is that the Australian Prime Minister has talked a lot about how, in some ways, this has implications for national security. In particular, there's quite a lot of Australians fighting in the region. At least 60 have been identified. And I know that Tony Abbott has been very vocal about wanting to bring an end to this conflict as soon as possible, because he's worried about what will happen to these Australians when they return to their home shores. So it's a fairly interesting situation within Australia, and one that was really brought to the fore not too long ago when a really shocking image of a seven-year-old Australian boy holding the head of a slaughtered Syrian was on the front page of a few Australian papers. So it's really in the forefront of a lot of Australians' minds at the moment.
Well, I think that picture travelled around the world. But tell me, Adrian, what's always interesting about Australia is that kind of that odd balance between kind of wanting to be involved in these global important, you know, events and sometimes feeling a little bit like it would like to pull back in and stay at home. So for the average Australian, does this feel like, you know, a wise move? Has there been criticism about his decision?
It's interesting to see that there has been bipartisan support for this move. So both Labor and Liberals have gotten behind it. But there's a fairly familiar refrain that's echoing throughout the columns of Australian newspapers at the moment. And that's got to do with the fact that it seems like, as per usual, Australia is kind of following the beck and call of the US. Although it's interesting to see that whenever Abbott talks about the situation, he kind of shies away from the fact that Australia's support is directly linked to the Obama administration. He usually tends more to discuss some of the, you know, the European partners that Australia is working with to bring an end to the conflict. So there is a bit of criticism within Australia regarding whether this is just us following the Americans again, but it seems like Abbott's doing his best to silence that.
Now, on a slightly different story, well, a very different story, this is a story about bikies, or Hell's Angels, as I guess it'd be called in any other country. Now, this almost, for every other nation, this would take you back to the 70s or the 80s. We haven't seen these biker gangs in many countries for many years. Well, certainly not in the way they're so active in Australia. But now they're going to court. They want their day in court. They're trying to get some laws overturned. Could you tell us about this as well?
As you were saying, I mean, a lot of people associate bikies and biker gangs with, you know, movies like Easy Rider. But in Australia, it's a very real culture, and it's also very controversial. I mean, a lot of bikie gangs within Australia are associated with drug trafficking and a lot of different illegal activities. And in 2003 in Queensland, this really came to the fore when there was a really big brawl in Brisbane, I believe, and on the Gold Coast, sorry. And this kind of, you know, splashed across all the newspapers in Australia, and the Queensland government brought in some really, really strong laws, so much so that many people have called them draconian. So what these laws are about is, you know, for example, more than three bikies or people who belong to a so-called vicious lawless association, as the government puts it, they can't congregate in public. And even as far as the idea that if you belong to one of these organizations, if you're convicted of a crime, you'll get a longer sentence than someone who's also convicted of that crime but isn't part of a biking gang. So what you're alluding to is, in Brisbane, 17 motorcycle groups have enlisted the help of some really high-profile lawyers. There's some QCs in there, and they're trying to question, they're trying to appeal some of these laws. And the main defence is that they're not constitutional, that they're basically extraordinary and substantially different to what's intended in the Constitution. So it's fairly heated stuff that's happening in Brisbane at the moment.
And finally, Ned Kelly. This man never goes away. He's always in every story, it seems, about we do about Australia. Now they're trying to save his house. We should remind people, first of all, who Ned was and why he remains such kind of a charismatic kind of anti-hero for Australia.
Yeah, sure. So he's kind of like our version of Jesse James. He's a bushranger, which is the Australian version of a cowboy. And he's a very controversial figure. You know, he killed a lot of people, policemen actually, but he also kind of stole from the rich and is seen as this kind of Robin Hood figure. So depending on who you ask, he's a hero or a murderer. But at the moment, his childhood home is up for auction, and it's kind of caught the interest of the National Trust of Australia, or at least the Victorian division. They really want to save the house because it's fallen into horrible disrepair. It was almost demolished in 2009 by heavy winds. And it's a really significant part of Victorian history. I mean, Ned Kelly kind of grew up in this house between the ages of, you know, 1 to 4. His father built the house with his bare hands using kind of local, anything he could find in the bush. So it's really quite ramshackle. But at the same time, it's quite interesting. The house is on the same property. It's being sold on a property that also includes a really nice townhouse that's only 30 minutes away from Melbourne. So there's a chance that the house could be bought not by kind of a history aficionado, but just by someone who wants a really great kind of commuter house on the outskirts of Melbourne. But the National Trust of Australia is really trying to stop that happening, and they're crowdsourcing at the moment to try and get around $600,000 to buy the house. So yeah, if any of your listeners are interested, it's on the 20th of September. So you can pick up Ned Kelly's old digs.
And maybe you'll get 10% on the sale as well, Adrian. Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us. That was, of course, Adrian Craddock speaking to us from Melbourne.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. The time now in London is 18:40, which means it's 13:40 in New York. And it's time now where we review something in the world of arts. And today we're going to be doing music, because joining me from British Underground is Crispin Parry. Now, Crispin, I know you want to talk about four artists who you'll be going to be showcasing at the Americana Music Association Festival in Nashville. Just tell us a little bit about this event, first of all.
Okay, it shortens itself to Americana Fest. It's a convention, a music convention, which is sort of a popular way these days of the music industry getting together. Many people know something like South by Southwest, which is probably the biggest of that kind of event. This one specializes in Americana, which I guess if you were in America, that would be anything from the blues to the modern alt country that is very prevalent in Nashville right now.
And your role in this event?
Well, the bit that I'm involved with is called the Bootleg Barbecue. Okay. And our company is a producer of these events around the world. So this one has got a very Nashville country air to it. We're taking four UK bands who have that Americana style and putting them in the middle of the Nashville scene. But I would also look at events in Nashville, in other places. So we do Austin, Texas for South by Southwest, so where we take a more general kind of music, but we do one called Womex, which is in Spain this year. That's world music. We do a Folk Alliance up in Kansas, and that's roots music and Americana music. And we do even the Great Escape down in Brighton, where we've been taking reggae, particularly reggae and bass from Brazil. So my job is an ambassador to help export that art, our art of popular music, particularly stuff outside the mainstream, to the rest of the world.
Well, let's start with the first act that you've chosen. This is Danny and the Champions, and a track called Never Stop Building, bracket, that old space rocket.
Was it something about the great unknown?
Well, that's super nice. Tell us about Danny and the Champions.
I guess Danny Wilson, who is the lead person behind that group, would be our biggest sort of straight-up Americana artist in the UK. So he's been around in several groups, but I guess in the last 5 or 6, maybe more years than that, he has been touring the UK, playing his a very heavily American-influenced music, sort of just making a name for himself, and is now, I mean, because we're talking about a subgenre of music here, not everyone's going to have heard of him, but if you know that music, this would be one of the most celebrated artists.
And tell me about, you know, that authenticity thing. When he goes to the States with you, do Americans just listen to him for the music, or are they intrigued that somebody from, you know, outside of the US has kind of so got to know that music?
Let's wait and see, eh? No, I think I work very closely with the event to make this happen. So they have invited these artists to play. They have spotted them. They've seen them in Nashville and on the grapevine and want to invite them to Nashville. So the artists that we're putting forward are very much the ones that they want to see there. So they are a level where they would in government export terms, they're export ready. They're the ones who we should be taking to that place.
Well, up next, we've got Emily Barker and the Red Clay Halo, and this is a track called Dear River.
Show me bright.
I think I may want to come with you. This is Emily Barker. And again, give us a bit of an introduction.
Well, she is a resident in the UK, but is originally from Australia. She, in a way that we would encourage with new artists, went out to the Americana Fest last year as a solo artist, played on the BBC introducing show, and is going back now with the Red Clay Halo, her band, to sort of up her game and play to more people to get that record deal, that agent, that PR, that sort of thing.
And so where is she in her career at the moment?
She's at the right point to now be exporting what she does overseas. So she will be, she will have got to a certain level in the UK. I mean, we call it in our world, we say export ready, but that's in order that we can justify the funding and get everything through, the paperwork through. But she's at a level to be in the right place.
Now, you said that, you know, if you're into that kind of music,
yeah.
is there a problem for these artists that, you know, I literally, this is the kind of thing I hear and I love and I'm wooed by. But is there a problem for crossover with you, with some of these artists, that, you know, it is a bit of a niche audience?
I think there is. But what's really interesting is in March this year, there was a huge event in the O2. I think it played to about 25,000 over two nights. And that was called Country to Country. Now, that was made up of a British audience going to see. Now, that's, you know, proper straight up Nashville music. But there is an audience that wants to see that music live. Now, what we're dealing with is a subgenre of that called Americana over here. But there's certainly an audience that wants to hear that. And Bob Harris has a show that is listened to by many millions on Radio 2 on a Wednesday night. So there are people who want to hear this music. It's not, you need to seek it out, but it is there and it is really good.
And does that Americana, does it cross over a little bit with, you know, folk on the fringes?
Absolutely.
As well? So, you know, you could be somebody who likes a bigger act like Rufus Wainwright or something and come into this music through that direction.
Well, the biggest new Americana act in America is Mumford & Sons. Very interesting. When they became a stadium act over there, the Americana Music Association embraced that and said, this is an example of what we're all about. So that's a new band under the Americana umbrella.
OK, we're going to move on now. The next artist is Pete Molinari, and this is So Long Gone.
Calling you on the telephone.
Well, a bit more of a kind of a rock route into Americana there. And Pete, who's he?
Pete Molinari, I believe he's from the Thames Estuary. What's interesting about that record is that that might be familiar to a bigger audience because it's produced and played on by a guy called Dan Auerbach. Now, Dan Auerbach is from the Black Keys. So he, that's another artist who can sell out the O2 or Wembley Arena. He's a big name. He produced Lana Del Rey's last album. So he's producing this guy, Pete Molinari, who I guess is a significant figure in the kind of garage, alt country sort of world. But again, you'd need to find him. You'd need to figure him out. So if you're a Mojo reader, you might know about him. But outside of that, maybe not.
Stupid question, but are these people kind of a set? Do you think, I mean, would they all kind of know each other? Are they moving in similar festival circles?
I don't think they are. Pete Molinari, I think, is in a different group of music makers and musicians. I think he has actually lived out in Nashville for a little while. He's in a different group to Danny and the Champions. I expect Danny knows Emily Barker. Danny and the next record we're going to play, they're both on the same label, but I don't think there's a sort of distinct pack that goes around under the Americana umbrella, no.
They're not all on the same tour bus.
They're not, no.
Okay, and finally, this is Israel Nash, and this is called Rex Animarum.
Someone told me that he had just died. Lowered my head and I started to cry. Stood on 125th Street and I said,
well, there was almost a Mick curled lip at the beginning there. That's again, a really wonderful track. Israel Nash is British, or?
Israel Nash is from Austin, Texas, and I've included him here because the show that we are hosting...
That's a trick question, Israel Nash, then, because I thought they were all British bands being taken by you in the other direction.
But what we try desperately to do is make sure what we do wherever we go fits, and so... none of the UK acts that we would be taking to Nashville would be particularly well known. So we add to the bill artists that can draw a crowd. That's the way to do it. And also it shows that we care. We're picking good artists. Last year on this bill, it's called the Bootleg Barbecue, we had Sturgill Simpson from that show. He got signed to a UK label and then appeared on Later with Jules and is now probably the biggest new Americana artist in the USA. So we have to do that to be empathetic to what we do. We don't just go in there and fly our British bands in there and fly out again. We are about being part of what Nashville is about as well.
Well, Crispin, that was a really great romp through that. And just tell me, when is the Americana Fest on?
That's 17th to 21st of September. And this show, if you happen to be at the Groove in East Nashville, is on the 20th, on the Saturday the 20th, from about 12:30, barbecue and beer included.
Okay, as if the music wasn't enough. Well, Crispin Parry from British Underground, thank you so much for coming and joining us here. We're going to jump straight to another song. This is a song is called Friends, and it's by Eliza and the Bear. Well, that was Eliza and the Bear and their track, which is called Friends. And we're now jumping to a very different subject altogether. We're going to be looking at a brand new book, which is called Would They Lie to You? It's by Robert Hutton, who's just dashed into the studio now to join us. And it's a book, I understand, which is about how you can kind of spin your friends. What's all this about, then?
It's about uncommunication.
Okay.
And uncommunication is how you get from having something that you don't really want to say to having something that you haven't quite said. So it's, you see it when people have to make a public apology for something for which they're not really sorry. And there's a helpful guide to how you can do that in a way that leaves people unsatisfied but unable to explain exactly what it is that you haven't done.
And tell me the genesis for this book. I will say you did dash into the studio. That's because you've been at the House of Commons. You're watching Parliament.
So
is this listening to too many politicians that's kind of brought you to the space?
It is. Yeah, it's not just politicians. It's the people around them. So I'm a political correspondent for Bloomberg. And I wrote a book last year about words that only journalists use, journalese. And the point in that book was that journalists use all sorts of words to make things seem much more exciting than they really are. The thing about uncommunication is it's the flip side of that. It started looking at how people make things sound less exciting than they really are. So if you get drunk and cause a multiple car crash in which 15 people die. You know, you don't say that. You say you were in collision and there were fatalities. And I'm sorry if that did upset people. And you look for ways to blame your staff. There's a lovely a lovely quote that actually is at the start of the book that sort of sums it up. It's Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, who...
Who's rather
colourful, and at one stage asked, challenged about previous statements that he had made. He said, "I didn't lie, you didn't ask the right questions."
Now, your book then is, you know, it's both a nice kind of joust at the world of the politician, but it actually does use phrases, genuine phrases that we, you know, we are used to hearing all the time. It's not kind of made up. This is
this is all, and it's all fantastically familiar. And it's not just phrases; it's sort of how you handle a situation. So, for instance, last week we had letters from business people about Scottish independence, and we had a letter from 100 odd business people saying they were opposed to Scottish independence. And the next day, of course, you have a letter from 200 odd people who say they're in favour of independence. And there's a section which explains to you how to assemble this letter. And the vital thing, only three of these names matter, because this will be reported, you know, there will be three names at the top, and then it will say underneath, and 200 others. And nobody cares who they are. And nobody really even cares whether they really think it. Of course, what happened last week with one of these letters was that somebody said, "Oh, well, I didn't quite mean to be associated with the campaign in that way. I was writing this letter in a personal capacity and not in my capacity as chief executive of a large company." And this is beautiful for somebody who has written the book in which this happens, and then it happens the week before publication. So this will all be very familiar.
Well, I've picked out a few prime examples here. I think the first one kind of falls into the Rob Ford world, which is "I've never seen that," which means "I've heard it though, but I've never seen it."
Yeah.
So this is where you kind of just twist the language a bit to acknowledge that something's happened, but you kind of then head the people off in the other direction.
Yes, and there's footballing ones. People who've heard any football manager talk after a match, they are skilled in uncommunications. So if they say, for instance, "Well, a few key decisions cost us today, Brian," what they mean is it's the referee's fault that we lost. And if they say, "Oh, you know, I'd love to, but we can't compete with their resources," when we wish to justify our failure to beat a rich club.
So now you also have a section on how to kind of do social media and Twitter, and how you can uncommunicate there and create an unimpression. What's an unimpression?
Well, the insight here is that people take great stock on first impressions. So the first thing they think about you, and if you're very polite when you first meet people, you can then be rude to them for years afterwards, and in your mind. In their mind, you're a polite person, and they will just... tests have been done to show this happens. They will just ignore all of the evidence that you're actually quite rude. So an unimpression is essentially what some of us do, which is how the impression that we create to the world, that he's a terribly clever chap, or he's very smart, very dynamic, or whatever. And you see this with sort of people with good hair get promoted. Taller people are more likely to win elections.
You're quite tall, I must point out.
I am quite, but I'm not running for election.
Can I just ask you, we had a more serious point. We were talking earlier on about Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson, these two populist British politicians, and saying that, you know, they seem to kind of hog the headlines. Is that because they don't do what's in this book? Is that because they actually are one of the rare instances of people who kind of say what's in their mind? Or do you think even they are using these tactics?
I think they practice this at a higher level. I mean, one of the things that people will say if you ask them about both Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson is, "Oh, well, he doesn't seem like a normal politician, you know, he just says what he thinks." Both of these men are near the top of their poll, at the top of their party, in Farage's case. The idea that Farage is not thinking quite hard about how what he says will come across is naive.
And well, we need to get in a plug for your book. We're running out of time here. But it's published by Elliot and Thompson, and it's available now. And
Technically, it's launched on Thursday, but I think you might be able to find it in bookshops now.
And if you go to one of those kind of big websites.
It is on big websites.
Okay, good. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and sorry for making you dash across town. That was Robert Hutton, and his book is, as we say, out now. And it also has the subline, "How to Spin Friends and manipulate people. Well, that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests at the top of the show, Shashank Yoshi and James Boyes. Today's show was produced by Phil Hahn and researched by David Pleasant. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Up next, it's Section D. And then at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily. But from me, Andrew Tuck, and this edition of Midori House, it's just time to say goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.